talk about the Song of Songs for the next several weeks. And there's several reasons for doing that, apart from the fact, as Garnett, my megastar, pointed out, that it has great embarrassment and awkwardness quotient. So it's a good way to just talk about things that nobody wants to talk about. But I have several things that I think the book helps us do, and I hope that through the next several weeks that we'll be able to at least introduce, raise questions in your mind, give you some ideas about the book, why the book is in the Bible, and what we're supposed to learn from it. One of them, I think, has to do with, one of the main ones, I think, has to do with the Song of Songs as a kind of exercise of reading. Y'all are either post-college, college students, or mature high school students, and therefore you all know how to read. But knowing how to make sense of a sentence is not the same thing as learning how to read, in the sense I'm using that. Learning how to read means asking questions to the book that you're reading, recognizing when there's something unusual going on in there, so that you know that there is a question to ask, and then having some sense of how to unpack what's being said in the thing you're reading. And those skills don't come along with just learning language. You have to develop those skills, and you develop those skills by reading and by rereading and by studying books that tell you how to read, and mainly by reading and rereading. So I want to use the Song of Songs partly as a way to train you in the broader issues of how to read Scripture. The Bible is a unique book. In some ways, its function is just like many other books. But it's God's Word to us. But it functions like other books in the sense that it forms the way that we have to read it. We have to learn what questions to ask and how the kinds of rhythms and patterns that the Bible gives us, and we have to, those come by studying the Bible. The Song of Songs is a really good test case for this because it's a very challenging book. It's a poem, and poetry is generally more elusive. It's harder to pin down exactly what's going on in the poem sometimes. The Song of Songs, that I'll point out in more detail in a bit, is more elusive than many poems. It's hard to know exactly what's happening from moment to moment in the poem. You can understand each sentence, but without really understanding the overall thrust of it. So it's a good exercise in learning how to read, and learning how to read the Bible in particular. And I think also, not only because of the quality of it, the poetic quality of it, but because it has, in some ways, it binds together, brings together a massive, like the book of Revelation in some ways, it brings together in a very small space. It's only 8 chapters long. You can read it in, you can read it several times a day if you want. It's very short. But it brings together all kinds of different dimensions of the Bible into one place in a way that few books do in that short compass. Again, that's something that I hope to illustrate in the time in the coming weeks. That there's a whole lot going on, a lot of different things are intersecting. The name Song of Songs, the title that's given in the Hebrew text is the Song of Songs, which is to Solomon. And that phrase, which is to Solomon, is a normal way of identifying the author of the book in the Bible. So it's the Song of Songs, which is of Solomon. The Song of Solomon is not, that's a natural way to describe it, but the phrase in the book itself is Song of Songs, which is a superlative. That is, it's the best song. The best song ever written would be one way to describe it. But it's also, I think, the title is modeled on. It's the same kind of grammatical phrase that's used for describing the most holy place of the temple, the Holy of Holies. That's the phrase in the Hebrew, and the Song of Songs is a superlative song in a way analogous to the Holy of Holies, is the most holy place, the most intense holiness, is in the very place where God dwells, in the throne room of God. And that analogy is something that Jewish rabbis often commented on when they talked about the Song of Songs. They thought of the Song of Songs as the Holy of Holies of the Bible. This is where you see, as they thought, God and Israel most, and their relationship most fully and intimately revealed. So it's a, all that is a way of backing up and unpacking the idea of using the book as a way of reading. One other point that I flitted through my mind, let me add this. One of the benefits of learning to read books like this, this is a book of wisdom, not only because it's communicating wisdom, teaching us wisdom, but also because of the way it's written. We have to have wisdom or skill in order to understand it. We have to be developing wisdom and skill in order to untie and unravel the mysteries and the imagery and the poetry of the song. So the very act of interpreting the book, the very act of studying the book, is communicating wisdom to us. The book of Proverbs, I think, functions much the same way. It's not just saying, this is what you do in order to be wise. But as you study the book of Proverbs, the very act of studying is making you wise, because you're learning to unpack, what's the phrase that's used at the beginning of Proverbs, to solve riddles and to discern the sayings of the wise. The very act of reading and studying the book is actually doing that for you. Because you're having to untie knots that are intricate and difficult. So that's one reason for reading the book and studying the book together. Another reason is, this may be news to you, but the Song of Songs is about sex. Is that, did everybody know that before you came? So, Garnett knew that, so if you didn't know that, you're behind my 9-year-old daughter. And that's another reason to take time studying. This is the Bible's most direct treatment of sex in a positive way. You have commandments and rules in the law. Jesus gives various kinds of commandments concerning sex in the Gospels. Paul warns against sexual immorality of various sorts. But if you're looking for a positive portrayal of sexual life and human sexuality, this is the place in the Bible where that's most obvious. And it's an important topic to address, because it's in the Bible, but it's also central to our identity as human beings. God created humanity, man, as Adam, as Genesis says, male and female. There are the sexual differences are created by God, and they aren't simply differences that have to do with anatomy or biological differences. It's not just a matter of women can get pregnant and have babies and men can't. There are biological and anatomical differences that we all are aware of. But those differences between male and female go much deeper than that. They really do define who we are as people. And that's why sexual concerns are so can be so confusing. Sexual morality is so crucial and central to our lives, as our ethical lives, our moral lives generally. If we have distorted or perverted sexual desires or sexual practices, that's right at the heart of who we are, and that proliferates into all kinds of things that creates all kinds of immorality and unfaithfulness in other areas. You're probably familiar with Romans 1 and the way that Paul describes the progression or regression of humanity as they move from idolatry through sexual immorality into immorality of all kinds. Sexual immorality, God delivers idolaters over to sexual confusions, and then those who persist in sexual immorality get delivered over into murders and strife and all kinds of social disorders, socially destructive actions. So there's a really basic. Our sexual identity is really basic to who we are, and our sexual morality has a great deal to do with our faithfulness to the Lord and our ability to live upright lives. If you get that wrong, then you're getting not just getting one small sector of your life wrong, you're getting a lot wrong. And there's going to be all kinds of sin that cluster around sexual sins. So we need to address it. We need to address it, obviously, not just negatively by saying, don't do this and don't do that, but also positively, which is what the Song of Songs does more obviously than any other place in the Bible. So against that, those introductory comments, my topics for the next tonight and the next several weeks are going to be, first of all, tonight I'm going to do a little bit of introductory, a little more introduction on the book itself, how the book is put together and how it works, how the poetry works, at least some introductory things about that. And then I want to look at the Song of Songs as wisdom literature. The Song of Songs is a song of wisdom. Next week I want to look at the song as an allegory. Both Jewish and Christian commentators for centuries have interpreted it as an allegory. That it's, on the surface, it's an erotic poem that has to do with romance, sexual love between a man and a woman. But Christian and Jewish interpreters have seen that as a symbol of God's relationship with his people. And I think that is an important dimension of the song and of marriage and sexuality in the Bible generally. So we'll look at that next week. And then get to what the implications are for sexual lives, our sexual lives, sexual ethics specifically, in the last time we did this. That order is important. I think there's a fairly popular way of reading the Song of Songs that reads it as kind of a sex manual, certain kind of sexual practices are being depicted in kind of veiled form in the Song of Songs. Mark out in Seattle.
Oh, Mark Driscoll.
Mark Driscoll, okay. When he teaches on the Song of Songs, he's taking it just kind of straightforwardly as a sexual, the sexual meaning is the meaning for us. I think that's definitely, it's obviously, part of the meaning of the poem. But I think if we start there, and if we just end there, then we're missing what really are the main, what's really the main thrust of what the Bible says about sexuality. When Paul talks about marriage, he talks about it as a type of Christ and the church. That's what the union of man and woman in one flesh is supposed to be. That symbolic aspect is not added to marriage or added to sexual union. That's what it's designed to be. That's why God created man, male, and female. One reason why God created humanity, male and female, is to depict that union and difference that exists between himself and his people. So we miss that, and we don't see that in the Song of Songs. I think we're missing a fundamental aspect of the poem. All right. Any questions about that before we look at the first chapter and a half or so to start? I'm going to read through the first chapter and then into chapter two. Although it goes past the chapter division, this is really the first section of the song. And I won't be spending all our time here, but I want to give you some, read it and give some flavor to what the poem is like. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. May you kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil, therefore the maidens love you. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will rejoice in you and be glad. We'll extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. I am black but lovely, the daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I'm swarthy, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? Or why should I be like those, like one who veils herself beside the flocks of her companions? If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats on the tents of the shepherds. To me, my darling, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of beads. We will make for you ornaments of gold with beads of silver. While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyard of En-Gedi. How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couches are luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedars, or our rafters are cypresses. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley. Like a lily among thorns, so is my darling among the mages. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He has brought me to his house of wine, and his banner with me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am most sick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hind of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. All right. That's the first section of the song, as I said. And that's, it might be a little hard to tell in English translation. You probably have, or you may have markers in your text that indicate who's speaking. Those, if it says bride, bridegroom, those words are not found in the Hebrew text, but you can tell by the form of the verb that it's a male or a man or a woman speaking. So this is a series of exchanges between the man and the woman. The woman starts, the man responds, the woman responds to him, and they keep going. And there's several little exchanges in this first section. But I think that that selection gives a sampling of the kind of poem this is, and the complexity of trying to get it, trying to understand what's going on here. We can think about just basic things. You start this book, and somebody is speaking, but you're not told who that is. You know this is Solomon's composition, but it's obviously a woman speaking. Who's the woman? We don't know. Where is she? We don't really know that either. In fact, the setting keeps changing in the course of, how many verses are in chapter 1? 17, and then another 7 verses. The first 24 verses, we've been in 5 or 6 different places. There's a reference to the king's chambers in verse 4. That's one setting. But then somebody is out with the flock in verse 7. The reference to vineyards there in verse 6. They seem to be outside now. The king's back at his table in verse 12. And he is able to smell the perfume of his beloved. Verse 13 seems to suggest that they're in bed together. My beloved is to be a pouch of myrrh which lies on between my breasts. Then they're out in some kind of forest in verse 17. The beams of our houses are cedars, our rafters, cypresses. That could be a building with wood rafters and ceiling. Or it could be out in a place where the branches of trees form a roof over their heads. The woman is like a rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley. She's out in the, seems to be out in a garden. There's an apple tree here in an orchard a little bit later in chapter 2. So you're, the scenes keep shifting. This is an imperfect comparison, but it reminds me of a music video where the scenes last, what? If a scene lasts 3 seconds, then people get bored with the music. I don't know how long scenes last. Very fragmented. You move from one place to the other very rapidly. And there is something unifying all of it, but there's this constant shift of perspective and scenery. And that's the kind of fragmented feeling you get at the beginning of the Song of Songs. You don't know who's talking. You don't know to whom she's talking. You don't know where she is, and in fact, she seems to be going in being She seems to be in lots of different places from the beginning. There's different sets of imagery. You've got a chamber, a king's chamber, which connotes a palace setting. A king's table is a palace setting. But then there's a pastoral kind of setting. The flocks and the sheep. You may know that there's a long tradition of pastoral romance poetry in Western poetry, where not always romantic poetry, but you have pastoral poetry where the poet is thinking of himself as a shepherd and he's out among the sheep, and that's the setting for a certain genre of poetry. And seem to be hints of that here, but that's not all it is. There's nature poetry. There's the king's chamber, but then you're outside a lot of time. You have these little fragmentary glimpses of what's happening, but trying to put it all together is not easy to do. And you add to that, one commentator on the Song of Songs has talked about the centrifugal impact of the poem. It's spreading out constantly. It's not tight and compact, but every line seems to take you somewhere else than the previous line did. We're trying to connect all together, it's not easy to do. And added to that, you have these comparisons, these poetic comparisons made that are not specific. The kind of comparison that's being made is not specific. So the first line, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." So there's a comparison between love and wine, and love is superior. But what is the point of comparison between the two? How is love like wine? That's not just a rhetorical question. How is love like wine?
It's intoxicating.
Okay, intoxicating.
Think about it, gets better with time.
Okay. Ages, okay. Think about both of those, I think, are part of the imagery here. But think about the specific of verse 2. "May he kiss me with the kiss of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." In that context, wine is also, it's a flavor, right? She wants to taste something. She wants to taste him. Taste his love. Of course, wine also has fragrance to it. You learn how to taste wine, the first thing you do is take a big snort of it. You stick your nose way down in the glass, as far as it will go, and take a big sniff. And you can smell gold in the wine. You can smell those grapes and the hillside. Try it. It works. You can smell the dirt.
You must be drinking better wine.
Down the road, yeah.
Maybe that's
a, is this one, true if the wine comes from a box?
I was going to say, one of the later glasses. So it's fragrant. Wine is really beautiful to look at. I like red wines. This is not about wine. red wines are beautiful colors. And you hold up to the light and you see the light shining through. So it's not just its intoxication and its taste, but it's also aroma and the look of it. You have all the senses are appealed to with wine. And then you think also about the different ways that wine is described in the way wine is used in the Bible. Where does wine come up elsewhere in the Bible?
Celebrations, feasts.
Okay. You know, which ones in particular?
Weddings?
The Lord's Supper.
Passover.
Okay. The wine feast in the Israelite calendar was the Feast of Booths, which just comes at the end of the year when the harvest is already, the grain has been harvested before, but the wine is going to be harvested right at the end. So I think that Jonathan's comment about wine getting better with age, that's part of the symbolism of the calendar of Israel, is that wine comes at the end. It's something that caps the year. After the, all the hard work, finally you get the wine done. And then you can relax because the year's all over. So it's kind of this future eschatological thrust of what the symbolism of wine. In the Old Testament, when priests went into the sanctuary, they were forbidden to drink wine. Leviticus 10 says they were not allowed to have wine. But now we've got wine in the Lord's Supper. This is a shift. So there's something happening with the drinking wine in the presence of God is now a normal part of our worship, a weekly part of our worship. When in the Old Testament it was excluded, being in the presence of God and drinking wine were mutually exclusive at one time, but now we can enter into God's presence and drink wine. So all that's, the Song of Songs is in the Bible, so when the Song of Songs mentions wine, all these other connotations of wine come into play. So the symbolism of the Song of Songs functions that way throughout. It's not just a one-to-one kind of thing where wine means X and only X. But wine, again, has this kind of centrifugal impact. It symbolizes all kinds of things at the same time. We'll look at another one. What was that? Oh, the lily. Famous line in the beginning of chapter 2. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley. Rose of Sharon sounds better than crocus. So crocus is the better translation. This is who's speaking here?
Brian.
One hopes. It is the bride. So how is a woman like a lily? How is a woman like a rose?
Delicate.
She's already mentioned the aroma a couple of times. The fragrance that comes from her perfume in verse 12 of chapter 1. Anybody know where lilies appear elsewhere in the Bible? This is a Bible trivia question. Lilies come up mostly in the temple. There's a lily design along the border of some of the furniture of the temple. And outside the temple, you have these two bronze pillars that are given names, and both of them have capitals at the top that are said to be like lily blossoms. So when you go to the temple, you're passing, if you're a priest and you're entering into the temple proper, going into the door, into the inside, you're passing between these two gigantic lilies. So there's a temple allusion going on here. And then there's interesting mythology that goes, in the background here that might be alluded to in ancient Egypt. The first thing that appears out of the chaos of pre-creation, you have emerging the lotus flower, which is the first thing that emerges as part of an ordered, beautifying creation that emerges from the chaos. So there may be some allusion to that ancient Egyptian or ancient Eastern mythology of kind of the creation as a kind of flower emerging from nothing. So you could go through every line of the song and think about it the same way. There's all the imagery of the song is going in lots of different directions. Again, the settings are varying. The persons are obscure. You don't know who these people are. There's speculation about who the people are, but we're never actually told in so many words. So what do you do with, how does all this hang together? Does it hang together, or is it just a bunch of fragments of different songs and poems? I think it does hang together, and it hangs together in a couple of ways. There are a couple of themes that bring the whole poem together. Now, one is, we can see this by looking at several passages that describe where the bridegroom is describing the bride. This is a footnote. The bridegroom I'm going to call Dodi. Dodi is the Hebrew word that's translated as my beloved. Those of you who are a certain age might remember Princess Diana. Arabic name, but the Hebrew is the same. Dodi means my beloved. So I'm going to call him Dodi. I don't have a name for her, but I'll call her the bride, but call him Dodi. One of the things that unifies this is that you can see this by looking at the way that Dodi describes the beloved as it progresses through the book. So it begins in the section I've already read, in verse 15 of chapter 1. It begins, "How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves." And then she responds to that, and he doesn't look on. All we get is a glimpse of her eyes. So we go a couple chapters over, look to chapter 4. And it's chapter 4 begins identically. "How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves." But this time it continues. "Your eyes are like doves beyond your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep, like a flock of newly shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. Each one bears twins. Not one of them has lost her young." So on. Starting at the top of her face, her eyes, moving down. And this one goes down as far as her breasts in verse 5, and then stops. Okay. This poetic form is called a wasif. W-A-S-F. Wasif. So, it's not an ancient Hebrew term, but it's an Arabic form that describes a person kind of member by member, from top to bottom, or from bottom to top, or top up and then down, or down and then up. It's an Egyptian love poetry, uses the same kind of form. You have this in Western love poetry. There's a tradition of that as well. So, but this time he has a closer glimpse of her. He sees more of her. He describes more of her. But it comes down to her breasts. Then you get to chapter 7. And again, "How beautiful," verse 1, "how beautiful are your feet, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels." You didn't see your hips before. The work of the hands of an artist. "Your navel is like a round goblet, which never lacks much wine. Your belly is like a heap of wheat." You notice it's going up from her feet. "And your breasts are like two fawns. Your neck, your nose is like a tower of Lebanon." You guys, try that out on your girlfriends. Like a tower of Lebanon. "Your heads are crowns, like you like crown out." Ends with her hair, then goes back down to her breast in verse 7. So this time he's got a full view of her body. So what you have progressing through the book is a growing intimacy. The bridegroom, Dodi, glimpses her eyes. The next time he glimpses her from her face down to her breasts. From the last time he sees her entire body, and he's describing the beauties of her entire body. So that you got that progression with all the centrifugal diffuse poetry in the book, you still have that guiding theme of an increasingly intimate encounter between the bridegroom and the bride. Another theme that goes throughout the book.
Can I interject a quick question?
Sure.
You're describing them as bridegroom and bride. Right. Are they already married at the beginning of the book? Or is there a point at which they are married in the book? Yeah. Is there a narrative progression?
I think there is, although it's hard to be definite about that. There is a wedding procession in the beginning of chapter 3. And the first full wasif that I began reading in chapter 4 is the culmination of that. So you start out in chapter 3, verse 6, and there's this procession coming. Solomon is named there. He's coming in his sedan chair from the wilderness up into the land. And then there's the description of the bride. And that seems to be that's usually taken some kind of wedding ceremony. It actually refers to David's wedding in verse 11 of chapter 3. And then he sees her. And then end of chapter 4, beginning of chapter 5, they are together in a garden. That seems to be a wedding night. But if that's a wedding, it's it's a kind of tumultuous one, because as soon as that wedding night is over, he's trying to get into the house, and she's not getting up to let him in. And so it's hard to see how that fits in an easy progression. But I don't think it doesn't seem if you're asked, I'm not sure the poem answers that question. Insofar as it does, it seems like the wedding would take place in chapters 4 and 5. Okay. So, bridegroom and bride are not the worst terms that are used ever in the poem. Well, my sister, my bride, she's called a bride. That's why I'm doing that in chapter 4. All right, the other thing that's going on through the poem, and I'll illustrate this with a couple of verses, is a progression in the status of the bride and in the in the status of the bride, and also in the impact that the bride has, and the, in some ways, the power that the bride has. If you look at chapter 2, verse 4, part of the section I read, she's speaking, describing her beloved as an apple tree. He's got fruit. He's like a tree. Again, you could speculate on the significance of that imagery. He says, he had brought me to his house of wine, and his banner over me is life. The term for banner there is usually a military standard. When Israel's in the camp, in the wilderness, there's certain tribes that have the standard at each point of the compass. There's an easternmost tribe, Judah, and then there's a northern tribe, and a southern and western tribe that surround the tabernacle. And each of them has a standard, and they all march out under that standard. It's a military idea. There's a kind of conquest here. He's brought her into his house of wine for a celebration that looks like a victory celebration of some sort. There's a banner that his love has conquered. When the term banner comes up later on, though, the relation between the bride and the groom is reversed. And instead of the bridegroom, Dodi, having hoisted up a banner over the bride, he's the one who's being conquered. Look at that.
Chapter 6, verse 10.
Yeah, that's it. Sorry. Thank you. I had verse 11.
Leave it to the newly married guy.
Well, we can back up, actually, and see, because this fits with the whole theme that I'm trying to develop. If you look back at verse 8, chapter 6. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maids without number. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique. She is her mother's only daughter. She is the pure child of the one who's born her. The maid saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines also they praised her, saying, "Who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, and as pure as the sun?" So she's become like that. She's really grown. She's like the dawn, like the sun, as glorious as that, as awesome as an army with banners. I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. That's the other place in the book where banners come up. But now it's not Dodi who's putting up a banner, but the bride is as awesome as an army with banners. That's describing his reaction to her beauty. He's overwhelmed by her. He's conquered by her. And there's a couple of other references to that same kind of thing in chapter 7, verse 5. Your head crowns you like Carmel, the flowing locks of your head like purple threads. The king is captivated by your tresses. He's fascinated by her hair. That's what he's talking about. Her hair he's awed by the beauty of her hair. But the way that's described is as a capture. He's the one who's been conquered. So there's this shift that takes place over the course of the book. The bride being conquered to the bride being the conqueror, you have this elevation of the bride, this glorification of the bride that's going on through the book. And I think that's particularly marked at the end of chapter 6, when you finally have something like a name given to the bride. She's called the Shulamite. And whatever else that might be in Shulamite is most basically the feminine form of Solomon. Shlomo is the Hebrew pronunciation of the word of the name Solomon. Shulamite, I don't remember what the Hebrew exactly is, but Shulamite is just the feminine form of Solomon. This is Mrs. Solomon. She's being described as a feminine Solomon. She's been elevated to the status of queen. That's not the impression we get at the beginning of the book, where she's being oppressed by her brothers and having to work out in the vineyards. But now, at the end of the book, she's been elevated to take a place along with Solomon, and even shares his name. So that's one of the unifying threads throughout the book, which I think makes the book really, in what some ways, a summary of the entire Bible, because that's what the entire Bible is about: glorification of God the Bride, glorification of the Son, of the Bride of the Son. Okay, questions about that? Before we say a few words about Song of Songs, that's wisdom.
I know most of when he's going through explaining, your teeth are like sheep and stuff like that, a lot of that can make sense, but how does her stomach being a bag of wheat, how does that complicate? That's the one I'm stuck on.
Yeah.
I can't understand how that's complicated.
You're not stuck on the nose like a flower? I think that...
circles are both of them.
Yeah, I'll try to answer that directly, but let me start out by saying I think it's a mistake to think that the imagery to describe the bride is primarily visual. If you try to do that, then you get some very strange. Were you at the Jeff Myers is talking about the Song of Songs at Bill Barrett's, and I lectured on a couple years ago, and he's always used a. The old Wittenberg Door, which is a satiric Christian magazine, has a literal portrayal of the bride of the Song of Songs. And they take all of the descriptions literally, and she actually has...
Yeah, they actually draw a picture of
it. Yeah, that's right, draw a picture of it. So he actually does have a hair that looks like a flock of goats coming down. She really does have honey dripping from her lips. And really does have a nose that looks like a tower. I don't think that's the intention. I think ancient readers would have found that as unattractive as we do. So I don't think that's not the character of the imagery. Sometimes it is, but I think there's always something more. I mean, there's at least an analogy between ewes that are recently washed and white. They're both white teeth, and sheep that have been washed are both white. So there's a visual analogy to that. If you push that, I don't think that's right. Another general comment, a lot of the imagery is drawn from the land. And one dimension of the Song of Songs is kind of a political dimension where the king is singing about the beauties of not just the people of Israel, but of the land of Israel. So the association of the places that are described here, I think that belly is a heap of wheat. Her navel is like a goblet full of mixed wine. If you think about that as a land full of grain and wine, it's kind of a Eucharistic image there, festive imagery. Think about the land and the bride being like the land. I think that's the kind of image. Again, you can think of a general visual similarity. If you think, a belly that's, you don't want a six pack on your bride in the ancient world. You don't want her to be doing some kind of abdominal exercise. You want a rounded belly. But I don't think it's primarily visual. I think it's the association of festivity and abundance and that kind of thing. All right. Any other questions? If you don't stop me, I'll just monologue. So please feel free to stop me and ask questions or comments at the end as I go on. Okay. Song of Songs is wisdom literature. That's where it fits in our Bibles. It's the last of the wisdom books, just before the prophets start. That's not the place where it's found in the Hebrew canon. The Hebrew canon is known as the Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H. And that's made up of three abbreviated forms of three different words. The Hebrew word for Torah, which is Torah. So that's the Ta part. The Hebrew word for prophets, which is the Na part, and the Hebrew word for writings, which is the KH part at the end. So you've got Tanakh, those are the three sections of the Hebrew canon, the canon of the Hebrew Bible. And in that setup, the Song of Songs appears at the end. It's in the writings. And that's kind of a catch-all category. That makes sense because the Song of Songs is a writing. But it's hard to see how it's a part of the wisdom literature, and so that's what I want to explore a little bit. Why did this book end up in our Bibles with the wisdom literature? Is that a good idea? Or should we just make up a category of writings for all the things we don't know how to classify, or does it somehow fit with the wisdom literature? On the one hand, it doesn't seem to, because it doesn't do the same things that the wisdom literature does. It doesn't talk about wisdom and folly. It rarely talks about the word wisdom, the word folly, those words don't appear. Rarely talks about righteousness, which is a major theme of Proverbs. It doesn't talk about knowledge or understanding. The word know is used only once in the Song of Songs. And just the form of it, it doesn't look like either Ecclesiastes or Proverbs. It's not wise advice the way Proverbs is. Proverbs written by Solomon, wise advice for a young man, his son, to train him to be king. And the Song of Songs is not that. So in those respects, it's obviously a different sort of book. It doesn't seem to fit with the wisdom literature. I think probably the reason historically for classifying with the wisdom literature was because of the author. I believe that Solomon wrote the Song of Songs. He also wrote Proverbs, and I believe he also wrote Ecclesiastes. So you've got three Solomonic books, and so they're classified either as the literature that comes from the hand of Solomon, and he's the king of what's known for his wisdom. That makes sense historically. But I think also substantive reasons for thinking about the Song of Songs as a book of wisdom. And at a very general level, you can say that both the Song of Songs and Proverbs are about romance. I don't know what you did with the Proverbs, but if you go over the first nine chapters of Proverbs, and I think the whole book of Proverbs in a sense is a romance, but particularly the first nine chapters, you have this choice before the young man who is the prince. He has to choose which of the two women, he has to choose between the two women who are competing for his attention. There's Lady Folly on the one hand, there's Lady Wisdom. Both of them are offering him things that seem good and pleasurable to him. And his father, Solomon, is directing him about which one to choose and the characteristics of these two women. So that's a kind of romance. That's a young man choosing who his bride is going to be. Proverbs 31 woman at the end, I think, is Lady Wisdom. That's the end of the story. And so Proverbs is a story. It starts out with this choice between two women. It ends with Lady Wisdom dwelling in the house. And that's Solomon's son made a good choice in that case. So when you think about Proverbs that way, then you can see that there's some more similarity, that the Proverbs and the Song of Songs are both about romances at different stages, in a sense. You have the choice being made of the two women in the Song of Songs actually have an intimate relationship between a man and a woman. But there's also, in spite of the fact that you don't have a lot of overlap of vocabulary, like words like wisdom and folly and knowledge and understanding, all those kinds of things, those don't appear in the Song of Songs. But you do have a fair bit of overlapping imagery and terminology between the two. So let me, if I could get a few of you to read some of these texts from Proverbs and maybe from some other places too. Joseph, could you read, look at Proverbs 9:2.
9:2.
Bethany, or Sarah?
Sarah, could you, do you have a Bible?
I don't have it on.
Bethany, Psalm 19:10. Megan, do you have a Bible?
Okay. If I need it to connect, right?
Okay.
My connection's not very good.
All right, look up Proverbs 8:7 if you can find it.
Yes,
sir. Remind me your name.
Brantley.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Brandon?
Brantley.
Brandon.
B-R-E.
Okay. Proverbs 3:14. Okay, that'll be enough. Okay. What do we got? And I'm going to read some corresponding verses from Song of Songs.
Right. 9:2.
Yeah.
She has slaughtered her beast, she has mixed her wine, she has also set her table.
Okay, and can you tell us in context?
Wisdom.
Okay. So wisdom is preparing a feast, and part of that is mixed wine. Song of Songs 7:2, your navel, we read this a second ago, your navel is a round goblet, which never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat, fenced about with lilies. So there's an imagery of mixed wine. In one case, it's clearly wisdom that's doing that. Here it's the bride, you don't know that it's wisdom, but the same.
What's mixed wine?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's wine mixed with spices. Maybe it would be a spiced wine. It wouldn't be a mixed drink.
Something like that.
The ancient world had beer. They had merged to make alcoholic beverages from grains. Yeah, they had wine from grapes and other fruit. But they did not distill anything. So they didn't have any hard liquor. No scotch. It's the darkness of the world.
The psalmist says about the law of the Lord, they are more desirable than gold, yes, than much fine gold, sweeter than also than honey in the drippings of the honeycomb.
Okay, that's from Psalm 19,
mm-hmm.
And in verses. There it is. Song of Songs 4:11 says, "Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon." So there, in the psalm, it's, the word of the Lord is like honey. Here it's the mouth of the bride. It's like honey. Okay. Were you able to connect?
I got it. 8:7?
Yeah.
"For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips."
Yeah, the word there for mouth is, can be translated as palate, which is the same word that's used in Song of Songs 2:3. Like an apple tree, "I'm under the tree of the forest, so is my beloved among them. In the shade of the grape vine, I sat down, and its fruit was sweet to my taste, to my palate." What was the other one I had?
3:14.
Yeah.
"For the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold."
Yeah, the connection that I have there is the connection with the description of the bridegroom, who is said to have head like gold, pure gold. His locks like clusters of dates, black as a raven. So there's imagery that's shared between the wisdom psalms, the Proverbs, and the Song of Songs. And some of these are fairly rare The term for mixed wine is not used very much at all in the Old Testament. So there's a similar imagery, sometimes of a similar kind of context, that unifies the books and makes connects the Song of Songs with the rest of the wisdom literature. So you think of the bride. This is an experiment as you read through. If you read through the Song of Songs, think of the bride as Lady Wisdom from the early chapters of Proverbs. What does that do to the way that we read the Song of Songs? I can illustrate with a couple of passages. There are a couple of places in the Song of Songs, chapter 3 and again in chapter 5, where the bride is asleep, wakes up, and in one case she finds that Dodi has left and he's not there, so she goes out searching for him. And then out in the street, she finds him and brings him back. The next time, she's in bed and he's outside knocking on the door. She doesn't get up immediately. When she finally does get up, he again is gone. And so she goes out searching for him. And in that case, she's searching for him and she encounters the watchmen who are guarding the city. And they beat her and steal her shawl. And then she enlists the help of the daughters of Jerusalem. They all were able to find Dodi and bring him back. So in two cases we've got, if the bride is wisdom, and the Dodi, the young man, the man in the poem, is the young man from Proverbs, we have a couple of cases where the young man seems to be wandering away from wisdom. He's separated from wisdom. But wisdom pursues. Wisdom searches him out. So yeah, I think in some ways you have a balancing between the Proverbs and the Song of Songs. On the one hand, Proverbs says you should seek wisdom, pursue it like gold or silver. Song of Songs shows us wisdom pursuing the young man, going after him, finding him, bringing him back, restoring him. So that would be one. There'll be a couple of passages where thinking about the Song of Songs as a wisdom poem gives us a different, a kind of different twist on it. It's wisdom, instead of us searching for wisdom, it's wisdom searching us out. The other thing is, this again, a kind of balance or a twist on what we find in Proverbs. Proverbs talks about, again, you should desire wisdom. Wisdom is the most important thing. You should search out wisdom, search for it diligently. The Song of Songs, if the bride, again, is a depiction of wisdom, that's been turned around because the bride begins expressing longing for the bridegroom, for Dodi. Wisdom, again, searching out the young man, not just the young man searching for wisdom, but wisdom is active. Wisdom is longing for communion with her lover, communion with the bridegroom. So there are dimensions of wisdom that come out in the Song of Songs, reading it as wisdom literature, that don't come out in Proverbs. It's, again, wisdom is much more you have this in the early chapters of Proverbs too, where wisdom is out in the streets, wisdom is calling men, the young men in. Wisdom is preparing a feast. But we see that depicted more fully in these passages of the Song of Songs. I think the other thing we can get from this, and this will be my last set of comments, quit. The other thing we can get from the Song of Songs regarding wisdom is a certain portrayal. That's not the word I want. Certain ways of thinking about wisdom that might be surprising to us. If the Song of Songs is about wisdom, then pursuing wisdom has to do with delight and pursuit of beauty. Pursuing wisdom is like courting a beautiful woman. And that's coming out of the Proverbs, but it's more fully depicted in the Song of Songs. There's kind of an aesthetic dimension to beauty. A lot of what the bridegroom says in the Song of Songs is what Dodi says is celebration of the bride's beauties. those are the Wasit passages. And her eyes are like doves, and her lips are like a scarlet thread, like to you, newly washed ewes and so on. He's celebrating and delighting in the beauties of wisdom. And wisdom and beauty are intimately associated all the way through Scripture, as not just in the Song of Songs, but that's the first time we've had wisdom brought up in the Bible. It's associated with beauty and the skill in making beautiful things. It's Bezalel and Aholiab, the two craftsmen who work on the tabernacle. Those are the first two wise men in the Bible. They're endowed by the Spirit with wisdom to make furniture and other furnishings for the tabernacle. They need the Spirit's wisdom, the Spirit's skill in order to make beautiful things. But Solomon is the same way. His wisdom is the wisdom also to make something beautiful. In his case, because he's a king, the beautiful thing that he makes and the beautiful things that he celebrates is the land and the people that he rules over. The Song of Songs and other parts of the Bible that talk about wisdom give it this artistic dimension that I think applies to you, whether you're an artist or not, whatever you're involved in, whatever kind of work you're involved in, whatever kind of calling you have, there's still an aesthetic, artistic dimension to it. You're still trying to beautify the world, and you need the wisdom of God to do that. And wisdom involves not just constructing beautiful things and making beautiful things, but also appreciating that beauty. The Song of Songs also shows us that pursuing wisdom is all about desire and passion. It's not, pursuing wisdom is not a objective, passionless evaluation and assessment of the world. That's not how you become wise. If the Song of Songs is depicting wisdom and the pursuit of wisdom, that means that desires and passions are at the heart of the pursuit of wisdom. It's not a again. It's not just an academic or a scientific kind of pursuit. Scientific in the wrong kind of sense. I think scientists pursue the wisdom that they get because of their desires and passions. Because of their desire, they want something beautiful. If you ever listen to a scientist talk about. A great scientist talk about the theories that he's developed and why he likes the formula that he came up with. It's because it's elegant. It's because it's beautiful. That's the standard. But that's at the heart of pursuing wisdom. It's have passions that are direct, obviously in the right direction. But the Song of Songs is depicting. It's giving us a portrayal of the passion and desire for wisdom that we should cultivate and pursue. All right. I think that's all I'm going to say. Questions about all that?
Peter, they usually have about 50 questions when I get done teaching.
Oh, yeah?
So. I do have a question.
Yeah.
The way you've described the relationship between Proverbs and Song of Solomon makes it sound as though they're very complementary.
Mm-hmm.
Proverbs seems to be especially directed towards a young man, a father teaching his son how to pursue wisdom, and it's this courtship kind of thing. Is it possible that Song of Solomon is especially directed towards young women and how to pursue wisdom?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I'd have to think more about what that means, but that would be, I'd have to think more about that. Did you have thoughts about what are the implications of reading it?
Yeah, I do have some thoughts along those lines. I mean, I won't say a whole lot. I think it's interesting. What is your take on, you know, the way my Bible has it marked out in New King James translation? You have the daughters of Jerusalem. I mean, is that, would you take them as also having a speaking part? I mean, do you see that as a...
Yeah, a few times. It depends on where you're talking about. They do, in chapter 5, they respond to the bride.
Yeah, and in the New King James, they've identified several other speaking parts for the daughters of Jerusalem, and I know there's some ambiguity to those. But I do wonder, there seems to be a kind of back and forth between the bride and the daughters of Jerusalem, almost as where, you know, she is teaching them. And I wonder if that's not her discipling them and imparting wisdom to them, to the young women of the city.
Yeah. Well, there's you do have that in the second scene where they're two are separated, and that's a case where the bride gets beaten up in the streets, and the daughters of Jerusalem, in what sounds like a skeptical question, something like, what is your beloved like? How can he be so great that you're willing to go out in the street searching for him? And then that's where she gives her wasif,
right,
the bridegroom. And then they all say, where'd he go? Let's go find him. After she describes him, their desires to see the bridegroom are awakened. They want to go with her and find him. So yeah, there's definitely and that may be another place where we have a shift in the course of the poem, because I'm not sure she's in that kind of dominant position at the beginning in relation to the daughters of Jerusalem. She may be growing up to be the chief among them.
I have a question. So if it's like a Proverbs carryover, in the female part would be wisdom, kind of like a Jesus, like a Christ figure,
yeah,
right? Then in the scenario of God and his people, is the female then the people?
Yeah, I think the gender of wisdom has been a I don't have a real clear answer to that, because even in Proverbs you've got passages that
like Proverbs 8.
Proverbs 8, the third fathers all took as it talks about wisdom being with God at when he created the world. There's this long passage about her role in creation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take that into the New Testament, it seems to be talking clearly about Jesus. Jesus is called the wisdom of God, 1 Corinthians. So but in the Song of Songs, the Proverbs, Song of Songs, both, the woman is doing Christ-like things. I think of that in terms of relation to that scene with the wisdom going out searching for the man in the streets, and she gets beaten while searching for him. I think there's seems to be some Christological dimension to that. So I guess that at the same time, I think you just have to shift gears as you look at different layers of it. So in one sense, the bride is wisdom pursuing the young man. In another sense, this is Israel, the church. In that case, she's Israel and Yahweh. In that case, the bride is Israel, and Yahweh is the Lord. I'm not sure you can match those up all the time.
But I think that's something that you find in the New Testament as well. Like in Ephesians 5, it's Christ and the church, husband and wife. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, it's father and son, husband and wife. So in Ephesians chapter 5, it's the husband who plays the Christ-like role. In 1 Corinthians 11, Christ is matched up to the wife. So I do think that multivalent way of looking at it is there in the Scripture.
Can you say that one more time?
Yeah, so the whole thing?
No, just the part about how that same...
Okay, yeah, so... So in Ephesians chapter 5,
mm-hmm.
Christ corresponds to the husband.
Okay.
In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Christ corresponds to the wife.
Okay.
And so the fact that wisdom is depicted in feminine terms,
mm-hmm.
I think you see Jesus himself in a feminine relation to his father in 1 Corinthians chapter 11.
Okay.
So there is more than one way to look at it, I guess is what I'm getting at.
So the head of the woman is the man, the head of the man is Christ, the head of Christ is God. That's
right,
the
exactly. That's the sequence in 1 Corinthians 11.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks. Can I close the curtain? Mm-hmm. Father, grateful to you for the word to us. Thank you for the beauties of it and for the challenges of it. We pray that you would make us good readers of your word. And in doing that, that you grant us wisdom as we try to unravel the mysteries of the scriptures. We pray too for your spirit to enliven us, to dwell deeply within us. We pray that your spirit would fill us with zeal to know wisdom, to pursue wisdom. Your spirit will give us the wisdom which is the mind of Christ. We pray this for the glory and the sake of Jesus Christ. Amen.